You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Put on the headphones.
After Chris Christie's successful tenure as a U.S. prosecutor, the New Jersey GOP positioned him as its poster boy for sober conservatism. Since then, he has defeated the state's incumbent governor, waged a battle against income taxes and labor unions in his state, and was pegged as a possible vice presidential candidate in this year's presidential election. He's also ruffled a lot of feathers along the way, but 2 days ago, a new Rutgers University Eagleton poll showed that Governor Christie now has a 50% favorability rating in New Jersey, up 4 points since March. Two veteran Garden State reporters have co-authored a book about the governor's personal and political background called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. It's published by St. Martin's Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Bob Engel and Michael Simons to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Hi there.
For a lot of people, Chris Christie came out of nowhere to assume New Jersey's governorship, but didn't his road to the governor's mansion begin in the early 90s?
It did, yeah. Over in Morris County, a very Republican county in New Jersey, he moved there and pretty quickly embarked on a career in politics that was sort of short-lived. He tried for a state legislature when there was already an incumbent there, and that ruffled some feathers. He tried for county freeholder when there was already an incumbent there, won that seat, and then had a kind of tumultuous time on the freeholder board. There were, by the end of his time there, there were three different lawsuits he was a party to, either served on him or that he served on political opponents, and they chased him out of office after one term and rather gleefully hoped that they had ended his political career.
Well, why had he gone into politics in the first place? Because you described him as somebody whose only goal was to become a lawyer.
Well, actually, when he was 7 years old in the second grade, the teacher found him out there by the flagpole all by himself. So she went out to see what the problem was, and he looked up at her and he says, "Someday I'm going to be president." And I ran that story past his younger brother, Todd, who, of course, couldn't remember that. But he says, well, it's probably true, because when he was 10 years old and we were talking about what we wanted for Christmas, he wanted a law book. So I guess maybe between 7 and 10, he figured out the best way to be president is to become a lawyer.
Was he inspired when he met Tom Kane, who at that point was just a state assemblyman?
Yeah, he'd always had an interest in politics, and then Kane came to his middle school when he was running for governor the first time. It was the time that Kane didn't wind up winning the nomination, but he was running in 1977, and so Christie, at age 14, I think, at that point, he hadn't quite turned 15 yet, sees Kane come to his school, is inspired, says, "Mom, I want to volunteer for this guy." And his mom drives him over to Kane's house, which was nearby, and drives up the driveway, which is something that probably hasn't happened in the year 2012, but could back then, and makes him get out and knock on the door himself and says, "If you want to do this, you go knock on the door, but I'm not doing this for you."
Now, he grew up in Livingston, which is an affluent suburban town in northern New Jersey, but his family wasn't as comfortable as some of the others. But was it preordained that he'd always be a Republican?
No, actually. His mother, who has had a lot of influence on him, of course, and his grandmother were both staunch Democrats. It was his father who was a Republican. But every night around the dinner table, they would discuss the day's events, and that included what was going on in the world. Everybody was supposed to know something. Everybody was supposed to take part. And from that, you get his attitude you see today. It's all right to argue back and forth. That's not a problem. You're supposed to get involved.
But was that what caused all that trouble when he was on the Morris County's Board of Freeholders?
Yeah, sort of that outspokenness. It was and is, and almost always has been, a Republican county. And he sort of got into office recommending all sorts of changes, ethic sorts of things, health care for elected officials and pay cuts and what sorts of contracts should be bid and things like that, and basically telling fellow Republicans, "You're not doing a good job running the county," and got into a whole thing about a contract for a county jail, and eventually forced the architect to lose that contract, and they rebid that out. And
architect sued him for defamation.
Right, yeah, that was one of the lawsuits that he was involved in. And so it was a very tumultuous time because essentially it was an all-Republican county, and he was still going after them and saying, basically, "You're doing a lousy job."
Well, so he had that confrontational style that we still associate with him. Did he learn anything from the problems that he had created then?
Well, he didn't learn to stay out of politics, obviously.
In fact, he was moving on to an attempt at higher office almost immediately.
He was, right after he got elected to local office.
And, 4 weeks later.
Yeah, and that didn't work out too well. And then when he went to run for that county office again, he lost in the primary. And this was devastating for him. He said that maybe politics isn't my thing. Maybe I need to find some other way to be in public service. So he had all but written it off at that time.
Around this time, he also changed his feelings about abortion. What happened?
Right, yeah. When he and his wife were expecting their second child, their first daughter, he went and saw the ultrasound and said that from that experience, he began to rethink. He basically said he had sort of been a non-thinking pro-choice politician before that point. So he said that sort of set that in motion where he started to reconsider his position on that. Even sometime after that, though, there were still times when votes were coming before the Freeholder Board, and there were other occasions where he still described himself as pro-choice. So I think it's a change that he sort of came to slowly. It wasn't like flipping a switch, but that was the event that started that.
And he's changed his positions on a number of things, and yet he hasn't been called a flip-flopper. Is it because it happened so gradually?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose that, you know, I think to a limited extent, his conservative opponent in the 2009 governor's race tried to make a point of some of that, but the establishment Republican Party was so eager to have him be the candidate that it didn't get a lot of traction. I think if he were to ever try for higher office, you'd probably see some of those positions be explored and exploited in a national campaign.
Now, you mentioned that he lost his bid for reelection for Freeholder in 1997. Why did people throw him out of office?
Well, the establishment there was tired of him rocking the boat, basically. So he didn't have the support from his own people, the Republican Party. They thought he was a pain in the side.
So they allowed a Democrat to win?
No, that was a primary.
Oh, that's a primary. He left politics for a time and helped set up a profitable lobbying arm for Dugie and Hewitt, a law firm where he'd been made partner. Is it common for lawmakers to work as lobbyists before they run for office?
Not exactly, no.
It usually works the other way around.
Right, pardon me. Yeah, his longtime friend and a law partner there, Dugie Hewitt, Bill Palatucci, had a large role in – he already sort of had established himself as a lobbyist and was trying to create that that division there at Dugie and Hewitt. And Christie helped him along that way. You know, I think that Palatucci had a much bigger role in that, but certainly Christie was, you know, meeting with clients on occasion, would go down to Trenton.
And he also raised more than $500,000 in 1999-2000 for George W. Bush's presidential campaign. Is that how he came to the attention of George W. Bush?
Well, it didn't hurt. I would imagine, yes. Palatucci, his good friend for a long time, had worked for the first President Bush and had got to know those people. So he knew the son. And in fact, he tells a story about George W. coming into Newark Airport, and he would pick him up, and he would put his cowboy boots up on the car dash, and they would ride around and talk about stuff. He has some great stories, but he was on the inside of that particular group.
And George W. Called him Big Boy.
Big Boy, that's right. He had a nickname for everybody.
So but that means that people are already noting that Chris Christie was not the thinnest politician around?
Be hard to ignore.
Uh-huh. So did they have a good relationship?
With the president?
Bush, yeah.
Well, as far as I can tell, it went well. Well, he did nominate him, so I don't know of any. In our research, I don't think I found anything where there were any disagreements. Now, there was a time, we have it in the book, where he wound up twice on a list to be fired.
Shortlisted during the time when they were getting rid of the U.S. attorneys.
That's correct.
There was an event a short time ago, within the last few months here in New York, actually, where Bush's post-presidential foundation was having an event on the economy. And Christie came and spoke at it and was talking, you know, with pride about having been a member of the Bush team and things. And it's still, I think, at a point where not all Republicans are embracing that relationship with former President Bush. But Christie had no problem about it that particular day.
My guests are Michael Simons and Bob Engel, who have written Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Well, Bush did name him a U.S. attorney. Christie had worked as an attorney for a number of years, but at that point he'd never been involved in a criminal defense case. So many people felt that he was not necessarily the best candidate for the job.
There were people who were actively campaigning against it, as a matter of fact. They were saying this was cronyism. The only reason he got the job is because he raised money for President Bush, and then he really shouldn't have it.
And you say a number of people felt that New Jersey Senators Corzine and Torricelli should have blocked Christie's appointment as U.S. attorney. But it was just a coincidence that Bush offered him the job on the afternoon of September 10th, 2001.
Right. Yeah, that came late in that day, and Christie wound up taking the next day off from work. And obviously then nobody anticipated what was going to be happening that particular day.
Well, then he could be fast-tracked because people were not really paying much attention to that sort of thing.
Yeah, and there was sort of a feeling that this is the president's choice, and while this might not be my choice, you know, there was nearly 700 people from New Jersey who were killed that day. One of the planes took off from Newark Airport. So there was a certain feeling of we're going to give the president his choice. And so that, in a peculiar way, probably wound up helping that nomination eventually get through. I mean, Bob Torricelli had some ethics issues circling around him at that time, and the prosecutor's looking at him, so he may not have been sort of the best choice to block that nomination just because it may have looked bad. I don't even think he necessarily wanted to, and so it was sort of left to Corzine if that was going to happen, and given what happened later on, it's sort of ironic that he didn't use that trick.
Because if Corzine had, maybe he wouldn't face Chris Christie later and
certainly,
lost that
election. He might still be governor, actually.
Christie kind of prioritized terrorism cases, and that got him into a certain amount of controversy. He's called the case against the Fort Dix Six the one he felt most gratified by. Is that case still considered controversial? There was just a ruling yesterday in the U.S. Supreme Court on it. Confirming the conviction.
Mm-hmm. The court's not going to take that case. And that, there was one involving allegations that somebody was attempting to buy a missile and shoot down a jet, which was all sort of, it was a sting operation, for lack of a better way to put it. So one of the criticisms is that in both, you know, the Fort Dix case and the Lacani case, that it wasn't thwarting attacks that would have been happening if not for you setting them up for that kind of.
And the case you just mentioned, the Lacani case, This American Life produced a story the same year that he was successfully prosecuted, 2005, for dealing illegal arms to FBI agents who posed as terrorists. This American Life said, maybe he wasn't guilty, and many now question whether or not the state was too aggressive. Was Christie's aggressive prosecutorial approach ever considered a problem at the time?
I don't necessarily think you heard a lot about it in those terrorism cases, but that's sort of a common theme that you would also hear sometimes from people who were critical of some of the public corruption cases, is that in many of these instances, it was, you know, it was through informants and not informing on things that were happening, but it was through essentially bribes that they were placing, essentially, that they were arranging to be placed to a public official. So that is certainly a criticism lodged at him. You hear it more in the public corruption cases within New Jersey, but certainly you can also apply that kind of criticism on some of the terrorism cases.
He went after Republicans and Democrats. The very first one was a Republican. But because of the pool that we have in New Jersey, we have more Democrats in the public employment pool. So the Democrats chose to point out that a great many of these people that he went after were Democrats.
Well, you've written about that in your another book, The Soprano State. Mm-hmm. We will come back to my guests, Bob Engel and Michael Simons. We hear a lot from Chris Christie, but Bob Engel and Michael Simons are here to tell us more about the current New Jersey governor. Their new book is called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We're back with Bob Engel, who's co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Soprano State. Also, you may remember, made into a documentary. He's a veteran journalist and broadcaster covering New Jersey mostly. Michael Simons, his co-author on the book we're discussing, is a veteran New Jersey journalist currently based in Press Row in the New Jersey State House in Trenton. And they've collaborated on a book called Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. It's published by St. Martin's Press. So, you say that Christie was much more visible and vocal than previous U.S. attorneys. Do you think that he had his sights on higher office? It was the sort of approach that Rudy Giuliani took here in New York.
Well, let's go back to that second grade conversation that he had when he was seven. He certainly did then. So I guess you could legitimately say that he's always had his eye on something bigger and better.
Well, how aware were New Jersey voters of Christie at this point? Did they recognize his name? Were they familiar with his cases in connection with his name?
Not really. They knew that there was somebody doing something more with public corruption than had been done before. But it wasn't really until they got into the campaign with Corzine that people started to realize who he was, and then they made the connection between the crime buster and the guy running on the Republican ticket.
In 2006, you mentioned earlier, a number of U.S. attorneys were fired by the Bush administration because they were not deemed politically loyal enough. And Christie was on the short list a couple of times?
Right, yeah. At the start of that process, when they were first setting out to come up with, you know, folks to let go, he was on sort of a second tier, so to speak. He wasn't on the main list.
What had he done wrong as far as they were concerned?
It's really difficult to figure out, and I kind of hope he runs for president, because I figure at that point we'll finally find out what that was. But you know, it was just something as simple as a personality conflict. You know, he rubbed people the wrong way in his Morris County days. We've seen in Trenton some of the conflicts that he has with folks down there. So it's part of his persona. So you know, whether it was, you know, there were other people who made that list because they traveled out of their district too much, or they weren't aggressive enough on immigration cases, or different things like that. It's not clear how he sort of got on, got off, later on in the process, got back on, or got back off the list. It's peculiar to him. He tells a story about how when he found out he was on the list, he called down and offered to resign, said basically, "I don't want to be where I'm not wanted." And the person who he talked to said, "No, that would never happen. I don't know how that happened. Don't worry about it." But it's puzzling. When word got out that he was on that list, there was, I think it was down in Capitol Hill, I don't think it was up here, there was a news conference where Chuck Schumer said, "How can that possibly be? That doesn't make any sense." So even Democrats were surprised, just because it seemed as if, to an outsider at least, that he seemed to have been doing a good job.
Well, if he rubs people the wrong way, it doesn't come across in this book. The both of you seem to be rather admiring of him.
Well, I think the book is pretty much down the middle. We have a whole chapter there of the controversy that he has had. I think it's something like tossing mud at Mr. Clean or something like that. We tried to be right down the middle and have the good side and the bad side. Where he is popular with this style that he has is across the country. Oh, and in New Jersey as well.
But he also seems to be much more media savvy than he was in the past. I understand he travels with two assistants who put everything that he says at a town meeting onto YouTube immediately, thereby circumventing any press attention.
Right. Yeah, it won't be the whole event. That would be 90 minutes, and you know, that would probably be too much for somebody to sit and watch. But yeah, almost every time they'll take a highlight or a snippet from it, whether it's, you know, him telling one of his more, you know, funnier stories or him kind of going after somebody. There's almost always a video or two coming out of those events. And some of those have taken off. I mean, a lot of what people from outside New Jersey know about him is just that 60 seconds that they saw him going after a lawmaker, going after a teacher.
So on the one hand, he's saying he has no desire to to go to higher office. He really doesn't want to be named the vice president's running mate, Mitt Romney. On the other hand, he seems to be doing everything possible to establish some kind of a national presence.
Well, to clarify, when everybody and his brother seemed to be wanting to get him to run for president, he said that he didn't think the time was right. And I think he was being sincere about that, because running for president 24/7 for at least a year, he's a family man. I think he just didn't want to do it at that time. But when it got
But he was
to,
also just a new governor.
Right.
People would have gone after him for inexperience.
Exactly. And then when it came around to vice president, he changed his tune slightly. He said, well, it would be presumptuous of me to say no when you haven't been asked. Or other times he would say, well, you know, that Mitt Romney, he can be very persuasive. So he left the door ajar on that one.
Now, many people remember his campaign against John Corzine as being a dirty one, but it also became important outside of the state. Why?
I think that the New Jersey governor's race is always, on a certain level, important to the political class because it's one of only two governor's races that is run the year after the presidential race. So it's almost always seen in some way as a referendum on how things are going and if people are happy with the new president or not. And perhaps not coincidentally, it hasn't been since the mid-1980s that New Jersey has elected a governor of the same party as the president who just won the year before. For whatever reason, it always seems to go the opposite. And I don't know if that's a reactive thing to, you know, being disenchanted, if it's just the cyclical way that things happen. It probably certainly doesn't help in terms of having influence in Washington if your governor is always of the opposite party of the president.
What did Christie say to you about the fact that peripheral issues like his driving record and his weight became important in the campaign?
Well, I think the weight issue actually backfired when Corzine ran those ads. There are a lot of people in New Jersey and across the country who weigh more than they would like to weigh, and they've tried to lose weight, and they resent the implication that if you're overweight, there is some kind of problem with you. When we talked to Christie about it, he said the thing that bothered him most was that the stereotypes that people associate with being overweight, being lazy or being undisciplined, and he really has a problem with that because he isn't undisciplined or lazy. The guy works really long hours.
My guests are Bob Engle and Michael Simons. Their book, Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power, published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Doesn't his aggressive, combative style make it difficult for him to work with the state legislature? Last week he referred to Senate Democrats as skunks at a garden party.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly they don't always have a close relationship. And for as much as Christie often talks about how, you know, he tries to differentiate Trenton from Washington by saying that he can work with the opposite party and get some things accomplished. And they have gotten certain major bills passed, you know, changes to public employees, pension, health benefits. But the flip side of that is that it's also, in many ways, more divided than ever before, and just as divided as Washington. Supreme Court nominees being rejected. About a quarter of his nominees for any jobs in his first 2 years didn't make it through the Senate. He vetoed more bills than I think in probably the last 20 years combined. He signed fewer bills into law than have been enacted in the last 160 years in any governor's first 2 years. So I don't know if it's because they come at things from a different way, because they can't get along, but there are definitely ways in which, for as much as they have had some successes, there have also been a lot of gridlock.
Well, he's positioned himself as a fiscally responsible conservative and asks his constituents and legislators to make compromises for the sake of austerity, which has led Paul Krugman, who is a New Jerseyite at Princeton, to refer to him as a fiscal phony.
Right, yeah, and I don't think Christie minds when Paul criticizes him. He kind of wears that as a badge of honor for what little that's worth. But, yeah, I think that certainly one of the ways that you sort of see that the fiscal phony line thrown at him is also through some of the tax breaks that are extended to corporations and things. There are those who think that for as much as he's being conservative on spending money on one side and you know, pushing for tax cuts and things, that there's also another side to that that's going to catch up to the state.
Well, he proposed a 10% income tax cut across the board, even though the legislature's chief budget officer says that the state has only achieved one half of the $1 billion in revenue growth Christie proposed. So isn't that a problem?
It is a potential problem, and it's a potential problem for down the road a short ways. I mean,
he says the state shouldn't spend more money than it has, and yet he's proposing doing that, although not always in the areas that Democrats might want him to spend it.
Right, and that's a forecast. I mean, no one's sure whether the Office of Legislative Services will be right, the governor will be right, both of them will be wrong. The truth of the matter is that he essentially gets to decide those numbers. So as much as the Office of Legislative Services may be issuing warnings, they did a year ago also have a different forecast than what Christie had. But ultimately, in the way it works in New Jersey, the governor sets what those projected numbers are going to be, and that's
but
what they're going to spend.
He's been focusing on income taxes, and Democrats in the state assembly have claimed that property taxes are the area where financial reform should take place. Jersey has some of the highest property taxes in the country.
And we do, and it's local taxes. So it's very hard for a governor to do anything about that, because property taxes usually pay for schools and fire and police and that sort of thing.
Although in the past he called for improvements in the infrastructure, he disappointed a lot of people in New Jersey and New York when he refused to okay the new railroad tunnel under the Hudson. The Obama administration has challenged his numbers and his arguments for vetoing the ARC tunnel. Has he ever been tempted to reconsider the position?
I don't think so. His main objection to it was, well, there were two. One was that the way the contract was written, and he inherited this, but the way it was written is that for any cost overrun, the people of New Jersey, the taxpayers of New Jersey, would be stuck with it. Well, how many public works projects, certainly on that scale, have you seen where there wasn't some kind of overrun? He said you just can't afford it. The other thing was, this tunnel didn't go to Penn Station where the other trains and subways are. It went under Macy's basement. So he didn't see any need to get to Macy's basement, particularly if the Jersey taxpayers were going to get stuck with the bill.
And I think the revised tunnel plans that are being talked about now are something that he may very well get on board with. I don't think that's all finalized at this point.
Because people argued that it would actually be a benefit to New Jersey to have easier access going both directions.
Right, and that's why I think that this new tunnel project that's being talked about, not extending the 7 line across, but this other tunnel, is something that you might wind up seeing New Jersey and the Christie administration on board with.
And it would go to the right train station.
Let's talk about his nomination of Bruce Harris, a black, openly gay Republican, to the state Supreme Court. The announcement came a day before gay marriage debates began in Trenton. Should that be read as a calculated political move?
Some people have looked at it that way. And this was not Christie's first nomination to the state Supreme Court. His first nominee, who has since been confirmed after a really long wait, is a woman named Ann Patterson. When he was looking at nominees for what became the Patterson nomination, Phil Kwan, who was his other nominee at the same time as Bruce Harris, was on that list of people that they were considering at that time. He wasn't that first nominee, but he was on the radar at that point. Harris was not at that point. He sort of came to their attention much later. I don't know that means that he didn't get a full vetting. I'm sure they vetted him, but he certainly wasn't back in 2010 one of the folks who they had on their radar.
Although we often see Christie joke with reporters and union leaders, we don't often get a personal picture of him. You say he's a diehard Bruce Springsteen fan. Isn't Springsteen an outspoken liberal?
Absolutely. It's the other end of the political spectrum.
That's like all those Republicans who love Bob Dylan.
But he has been to, 130 or more concerts, including some that were out of the country. Mm. He can't get enough of it, but politically, they're on different ends of the line.
He's also chosen to live in his family home in Morris County rather than in the governor's mansion, which is in Princeton. Isn't Princeton a lot closer to the state capital?
Absolutely, but he wanted the kids to keep going to their school.
And it's actually not entirely uncommon. I mean, Corzine spent occasional nights at Drumthwack at the governor's mansion, but he was primarily in Hoboken and sometimes in New York, for that matter.
One of the defining issues of Christie's administration has been his very public confrontations with the New Jersey Education Association, which is the state's teacher union. He's referred to them as a political thuggery operation that is fat, rich, and entitled. Why did it turn so nasty?
Well, they spent several million dollars trying to defeat him, for one thing.
Yeah, but other people try to defeat him as well. But did he call them all political thugs?
I don't know if he's called them all that, but he tends to defend himself when he needs to be. But there's always been bad blood there. And another thing is, in his reforms, education are very high. He wants to change teacher tenure, and he wants to have more charter schools and that kind of thing. And that's opposed by the teachers union.
WNYC's Bob Henley has written in a blog post that Christie's rise is similar in some ways or linked to Governor Scott Walker's. Do you see similarities there?
Yeah, sure, there are. I mean, he sort of made his name first by taking on public employee unions, and that's something that a year later when Walker got elected in Wisconsin was obviously something that catapulted him into prominence. Christie took a different tack than Walker. You know, in Wisconsin and in Ohio, there was efforts to essentially eliminate collective bargaining as a right for public workers. Christie hasn't done that. The teachers union would argue that that did happen over health care benefits, that the legislature did that away from the bargaining table. But by and large, Christie said basically, I believe in collective bargaining. It just ought to be more adversarial.
And New Jersey, of course, doesn't have recall elections in its constitution.
They're allowed, but they're incredibly hard to do. You need 25% of the registered voters in the state, not just people who actually voted, but who are registered to vote to sign a petition. It's a really impossible hurdle.
So although you say that he entered the governor's mansion as somebody who only expected to be a one-term governor, is your sense now that he's going to run again if he isn't asked to be Governor Romney's running mate?
Yeah, I don't think he ever said he's not going to seek re-election. The way that he tries to describe it is, I'm going to govern as if I don't care. And I think that, honestly, if he were to either not seek another term or lose re-election, he probably could find, you know, pretty well-paying jobs, whether it's in law or in media, you know, going into TV, whatever he could do. So if he's not running for vice president or going to Washington to work in a Romney administration in some way, I think that you'd probably see him run.
And he does have the kind of wit that appeals to the people at Fox.
Well, he's appealing to people across the country. It's fun to cover him, actually, because he's not wooden and stiff like the last two governors that we had. He actually is sort of fun because you never know what he's going to do. You never know how he's going to answer the question.
Chris Christie, the inside story of his rise to power, is published by St. Martin's Press. My great thanks to its authors, Bob Engel and Michael Simons, for being our guest today.
Thank you for having us.